You are listening to lecture number 5, Internet Continued, delivered by David J. Malin for Computer Science E1, Understanding Computers and the Internet, at Harvard University's Extension School, on Thursday, October 20, 2005. Visit us on the web at www.fas.harvard.edu/CSCIE1.
Welcome to Computer Science E1. My name is David Malin. This is Lecture 5, Internet Continued. In your hands by now, you probably have one of my favorite problem sets, Problem Set 4, the Internet Continued, because if you look at the last few pages of this thing, what do you notice you've been given? Sorry? A shopping list, along with 2,000 virtual dollars with which to go shopping at a local store. And this is one of my favorite parts of our problem set roster for the reason that you'll actually now, particularly after tonight's lecture, be able to go into a store and hopefully, if it is a successful problem set, realize that in just 5 weeks you now know more than the salesperson who's going to be helping you at the store. So among the questions you'll be asking are, what's inside of this computer, or what can you give me for $500? And as we note in the problem set itself, tends not to go over well if you happen to mention that your dollars are virtual, so we suggest that you leave that till the end of the conversation with the sales rep. But read through the spec and you'll see what you're to get out of this. But really, it's an opportunity to go now and look at labels on the shelves, look at the fine print on these systems on the shelves, and finally appreciate that, wow, you now know what they're talking about. You now know what questions to ask, and you know when the answer you've been given just doesn't make sense for reasons not your own. I saw a hand in back. Was there a question? Okay, fantastic. So good luck with that. You have a couple of weeks to tackle that particular project, but I think you'll enjoy it. On the roster for tonight is more about the Internet. Last week we focused more on the application layer of the Internet, focusing on what you can do with it. But tonight we focus on how it allows you to do such things as we discussed last week. What is a network? What is the Internet? Quite literally, we'll take the hood off of the Internet and take a look at how it works inside, along with a number of demos related there too. But first, let's start with the simplest question. We've sort of taken it for granted that everyone here knows what the Internet is, but can you define it in your own words, in just a sentence that is accurate? What is the Internet?
Software to surf the network.
Okay, I'd actually say that's not a good definition, though it has building blocks for one. What is the Internet? Yeah? Yeah, more of a interconnection of computers spread out geographically. Notice the emphasis in this particular definition is more on the infrastructure. And that was one of the distinctions we tried to make last week, which was first and foremost, the World Wide Web and the Internet, were they the same thing? Well, no. I mean, the World Wide Web, we discovered, was more of an application, a service that ran on top of what's otherwise more of a hardware-based infrastructure. So the Internet is really the network of networks, an Uber network, if you will. It is the largest network in the world because, by definition, it interconnects most smaller networks in the world. But now let's take a step back from that, lest we lose sight of where we started from and tease the word apart. Well, Internet suggests an internetwork. Well, what is just a network, quite simply? Single computers connected. So we could say two or more computers connected. So quite simply, we might say, and this is how I'll typically quickly depict a computer, it's sort of quickly becoming dated, but a monitor on top of a CPU, or the case encasing a CPU. So we might say that this here is a network of two computers. Specifically, what do you tend to call networks when they do involve computers that are, you know, next to each other, or perhaps are just two computers networked to one another? It's a special case of a network. It is a LAN. That would work. I heard something else. Okay, the individual machines could be called workstations, sure. This could be called a LAN, where a LAN, henceforth, will be known as a local area network. And all this means is that it's a cluster of interconnected computers that share some geographic proximity. So a LAN might be said to be all of the computers, if they're networked, inside of a classroom, or inside of a computer lab. Or you could be more broad about it, and you could say that all the computers on campus here form a LAN, even though there might be several thousand computers. Or you might say that a LAN comprises only the computers inside of a particular building. So it's sort of a, it's not a well-defined term, but its distinction is with the term known as a WAN. And a WAN is, W-A-N, a wide area network. And what a WAN really is just a network of, take a guess, LANs. So a WAN, W-A-N, is a network of LANs. So if you have, for instance, a couple of computers inside of what will henceforth be known as my depiction of a typical office building, a LAN, as soon as you connect this LAN to, say, another building, however far away it is, that itself contains internetworked computers, well, then you have a WAN. But where you draw the line is rather arbitrary. There are certainly no numbers that qualify a network as a LAN versus a WAN. And let's not forget the door. So there we have a WAN. Taking a step back, though, if we look at these two computers in isolation, you could also call them peers, because in a sense they look to be sort of equivalent computers, but they are networked. So you could also call this a peer-to-peer network. And back in the day, when you did connect just two of your computers, even in your home, for the purposes of sharing files between them, well, that would generally be called a peer-to-peer network. But as many of you know, this term peer-to-peer network has sort of taken on a much broader meaning these days. In what contexts have you heard of peer-to-peer networks today?
Napster, Grokster,
LimeWire, all of the file-sharing networks that even if you haven't used them, you've perhaps heard of them at least. Well, those two are peer-to-peer networks in the sense, and we'll talk about them a bit more in our multimedia lecture, in the sense that they work as follows. Napster, which was the earliest of these, the most popular of these inventions, which got itself into quite the legal hot water, essentially was not quite a peer-to-peer network in the truest sense. The reason that Napster was ultimately prosecuted rather effectively was because all of the computers that were running the Napster software connected to a central server. And what that server did was combine, consolidate all of the lists of music that each of those individual computers had on it. And it's a brilliantly simple system, and it's incredibly straightforward, because if all of the, you know, college students throughout the country are all essentially uploading lists of the songs that they have to the central server, well, it's incredibly easy then to search thousands, tens of thousands of computers for some song you want, because that server can then say, okay, David wants this new Eminem song. All right, well, it looks like Joe Bob on the West Coast at Stanford has that song on his computer, so I, the Napster central server, am going to put David in touch with Joe Bob. And then it becomes more of a peer-to-peer communication. So even though the data, the actual music, wasn't being routed through Napster central server, the lists of file names were. And it's in that regard that they were ultimately held legally liable for facilitating illegal file sharing. Because of all the people on this network, they were in the best position to actually regulate what was going through their systems. So that's the context in which you see peer-to-peer networks today. But back to the situation at hand, this remains quite typical. You have a few computers in one building networked together. What kinds of things can you put on a network besides computers? Sorry? Printers, a wonderfully useful application of networks, been used for decades these days. So you have a networked printer so that everyone can share the printer. You can do this in your own home relatively easily these days. What else can you put on a network? If you work in the corporate context, you probably have one or more file servers, as they're called on the network. A file server is by definition a computer because it's a server, and a server typically is just a computer, maybe a faster, more expensive computer, but it's just a computer, but it too could be interconnected with all of the other computers on the network in, say, a building. So that's pretty much the predominant uses of networks within a small geographic area for sharing data, or for sharing data with a printer, or for sharing data with other computers. But let's dive a bit deeper into this picture. Since I've just drawn rather lazily with a wavy line exactly how these two computers are connected together, but suppose that the network is not so simple as to have just a pair of computers, but we now have three computers. The question of how to connect them becomes a little more interesting then, and a little more relevant to a typical network. So if we instead have at least three computers, physically located within some building or some campus, and the goal is to physically connect these computers together. Well, what do you need? What do you have to go to the store and buy to connect three such computers together? Okay, FireWire is one such option. I'll come back to that in a moment. A hub is another relevant piece of terminology that might come into play. What else might you need? Other things you think you might need? The cabling of some sort, the cheapest part, fortunately. Let's focus on that for just a moment, and we'll add these additional pieces into the puzzle. We have these three computers. Let's abstract away all the technicalities of what the cables are called and what the hardware is called that we actually need. But just physically, if I wanted to connect these three computers together, with what kind of topology would I want to do so? In other words, how, given a network that could consist of many different nodes like this, there's clearly many different ways to interconnect them with straight lines, aka wires. So what's perhaps the simplest approach? Okay, I hear serially. Oh, Wi-Fi, we don't even need the cables, but let's defer that for a moment and focus on the cabling for now. So serially, what do you mean by serially? Okay, so we could do that. One, two, three, and they're now all interconnected. We could make it a little simpler, too, because this sort of suggests that you have to have a way of going into the computer and out. So let's actually draw it a little more generally and just say that, yeah, there's this central line that's laced throughout the building, but attached to that line are the actual connections. So there's sort of like a bus route, using that term bus from our hardware lectures, a bus being a pathway along which data can travel, and there are all these little bus stops, if you will, at which point data can get on and data can get off. And that's sort of a reasonable analogy because this is exactly what people would refer to as a bus network. Incredibly straightforward. You want to connect multiple computers together, string a wire that goes pretty close to each of them, and then attach to that wire some kinds of connection points using the appropriate kind of hardware, and now all of your computers are networked together. Now, even not being an engineer necessarily, what might be a problem with this kind of topology or layout of your network? Sorry?
Traffic.
Okay, traffic in what sense?
Well,
there is a seeming bottleneck, and it might not be too striking given that we just have three computers, but if they're all sharing the same medium, the same piece of cable, well, presumably, if this thing is just, you know, some kind of wire, only one computer can probably talk on it at once, because otherwise, if multiple computers are trying to send their bits in the form of electrical currents, as we discussed in the first couple of lectures, well, that electricity is going to collide and it's sort of not going to make any sense to anyone. So yes, on a network, typically, only one computer can talk at a time, and though that might seem incredibly inefficient, appreciate that when computers communicate electronically, we're talking about the flow of electrons moving, theoretically, at the speed of light. But in reality, it's actually much slower than that, but it's still much quicker than any human could really appreciate in a physical sense. So it's fast, but it is ultimately inefficient, especially as you have more nodes or computers on this network. There's another problem with a network like this, particularly as it gets longer, the bus, and more computers are connected. So there's a distance factor. If we actually continue this bus to include many other computers, perhaps the delay, the amount of time it takes for data to go from A to computer Z becomes increasingly worrisome. Turns out that, again, because the data travels so quickly, that's less of an issue. Only when you start talking about stringing wires across the Atlantic Ocean, Pacific Ocean, across the country, does distance really start to come into play. In a building, not really. But it's a reasonable assertion. What else?
Failure points.
Failure points. What do you mean?
For some reason, in the middle of your long bus route, there's a pothole and you can't get through it.
Yeah. A good use of the analogy. Suppose that something goes wrong here. You know, you get the old mouse chewing through the wires, or someone tripping over the wire, or just generally there's a degradation in the wire, and so you now have what's called a partitioned network. You have two halves, this side to the left of the break and the other side to the right of the break. So you have, in reality, a single point of failure. That single point of failure is sort of stretched out throughout the building, but if just one part of it breaks, your network is now sort of damaged. All right, well, let's focus on that problem for a moment. How could we eliminate this so-called single point of failure and keep these computers more robustly connected? Turn the corner, make it a circle. So we can do exactly that. So if this cable actually doesn't just stop there, but essentially continues in a circle, well, you have what's known as a ring network. That's a useful thing because now, even if you do have a partition in the network for some physical reason, well, at least the data can now go in the other direction. And if you've ever heard, particularly in years past, of token ring networks, if you've at least noticed that term, well, this is the kind of topology it's referring to, literally a ring of computers interconnected. But unfortunately, in the real world, as your physical spaces become more challenging architecturally, and as you want to interconnect computers not just in a single room that happens to be conveniently arranged in a circle, but that happen to be in the back corner of the room, and over there, and behind another wall, well, no longer is it as easy to just naively wire your computers in a nice, straightforward circle. You have to start to be a little more flexible with it. And so it turns out that though these are both feasible topologies, the most commonly one used today, there, say, is called a star network. And this is where we can start to now draw in some of those other pieces of hardware. A star network would put, and I'll redraw our picture to make it a bit more clear, if you have multiple computers connected together, what does the notion of a star suggest to you about what I should draw to represent this topology? Everyone is connected to everyone else, and we'll do that, in this case, by way of a central point, which is by far the most straightforward way of wiring a building. Imagine, after all, if you simply have some piece of special hardware in what might be called a wiring closet in your office building, and all you now have to do is, from everyone's office or desk, is run an individual cable from that computer to that central point. Now, granted, there's a cost implicit here. What's a downside of this approach, straightforward as it might be? Okay, you need an additional piece of hardware in the middle, which itself suggests a single point of failure. So you sort of have taken a step back from that previous solution. What else exists about this?
We also need more wiring.
You do need more wiring. And it's not obvious from the small-scale picture I've drawn here, but just imagine if your wiring closet, as is often the case in someone's home these days, people who are building new homes and sort of thinking ahead are putting this so-called wiring closet, or really just mess of hardware and cables, in the basement, just because it's one centrally easy place to keep everything. But that means now that all of your computers, even if all four of your computers are in the same room, you now need pieces of cable going from that bedroom or that home office all the way down to the basement. And so you're sort of using four times as much cable as you might have needed in the past. The reality is, though, this cable, as we'll discuss more in just a moment, we're talking pennies per foot these days, if that. So cost is fortunately no longer such an issue as it was in years past. So we've heard a couple of terms now to describe this central point. And let me ask first, how many of you in your own homes already have multiple computers? Okay, so about half of you. How many of you have those computers already interconnected in some kind of network? Okay, with what hardware are you achieving this interconnection? Okay, a wireless card, I heard. What else?
A router.
A router. And we heard another term earlier. A hub. A hub. And you'll... Well, excuse me for a moment. Let me just open the window for my own sake here. Let me ask one of the stronger teaching fellows to open the window, since I have the luxury of standing right in front of the heating vent here. But let us know if you get cold. So we just tossed out a few pieces of hardware. Well, let's tease each of these apart. It is absolutely true that you can interconnect. It's great that I just embarrassed myself like that. Next time I'll think to ask the help, the TFs to help first. Oh, I've just redeemed myself. So let's start with the hub, because this is what was commonly used a few years ago. It's still in use today, but it is not as useful as we'll soon see. So a hub is... There we go. A hub is essentially a dumb little piece of hardware. You plug it into the wall so that it does have some electricity usually flowing through it. But all it does is have a bunch of different ports or jacks on the back of it, the type of jack that you would find on the back of your computer. So recall that in lecture 1 or 2, we had that slide that that depicted a variety of different types of computer connectors, one of which was about the size of a telephone jack, but a little fatter, and that was called an Ethernet jack. So essentially, a hub has multiple Ethernet jacks on it, and what you do in order to interconnect your three computers is you plug each of those computers into one of those jacks. And what the hub does is, when data comes in from computer A, it simply, the hub, rebroadcasts that identical data to computers B and C. It essentially repeats the data, echoing out to the other computers. Meanwhile, when B wants to reply to A, well, clearly the data has to be passed through the hub, HUB, and so the hub, just as before, just broadcasts it out to everyone else. But I've taken care to describe it in a certain way. What is inefficient, clearly, about a hub, if not a security risk of it? Go ahead. Everybody does indeed get the information. A hub is, as said, a dumb device, and it just blindly rebroadcasts whatever comes into it out on each and every one of its other ports. That makes it a relatively cheap device because it's quite easy to implement that in hardware, but it's a security risk in the sense that even if A only wants to send some data to B, who else is receiving it? Well, computer C. Now, by definition of the software running on C, a computer by default will ignore any network traffic that's not meant for it. That's simply how Microsoft and the various software vendors have pre-programmed things like Windows or macOS or Linux to behave. However, it just takes someone with a bit of tech savvy to actually change the way Windows or macOS or Linux is working and to put their Ethernet card, as it's called, Ethernet being the language that computers tend to speak on a LAN, simply changing their Ethernet card into what's called promiscuous mode. Promiscuous suggesting a sort of looseness or easiness, and what it suggests in this context is that the Ethernet card starts listening to all of the traffic that visits it. And literally, if you have a network arranged with a hub as the central point, with the right software, which these days can be downloaded for free or for a cost off the internet, you can literally sit at computer C in your locked room and watch what computers A and B are doing on the internet. By that I mean you can watch what emails are going between computers A and B, you can watch what websites they are visiting, you can log what passwords are being sent from their computers over the network. It's a dangerous situation, but for many years, and even in a lot of networks today, this is still the case because hubs early on were incredibly cheap, and so they were installed. Even Harvard's own undergraduate campus used hubs back in the day, and you could, sitting in your dorm room, have access, though it was by policy, though not by technology disallowed, watch what every one of your neighbors and roommates were doing, if you had the know-how to do so. Okay? Yeah?
Is that only for purposes of internet activity? Would you be able to see, let's say, that you were working on computer A, you weren't sending an email or anything, but you were working on Word documents, something doing that?
Good question.
No,
this eavesdropping is limited only to the traffic going across the network. If I were just sitting there typing an essay and I was not interacting with the internet in any way, that data should remain isolated to my own computer. So you're not completely exposed, as it were. Well, fast forward a few years to where the price differential between a hub and a switch is nearly negligible, if not non-existent, and you have an almost identically looking device, but it's now called a switch. And I say it's almost identical because physically it pretty much looks the same. Manufacturers pretty much used the same plastic casing, the same hardware. The only thing they changed was some of the circuitry inside of these devices. But physically, and just to give you a historical perspective, back in the day, hubs and switches were probably devices that were about this long and this wide and maybe, pretty narrow, but they would often fit on racks and computer racks and a hardware center. Well, over time, they've gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. You buy them today, you can get them this big. Now, granted, that's not an enterprise quality one. You can get it for $5 or $10, but certainly for a home network, it achieves the job. And even when just 10 years ago, they were, probably twice this big. But that's always the case, it seems, in this world. Well, take a guess as to what a switch does that is an improvement over a hub, given our emphasis of this one particular problem. It only delivers data to the specified computer. So if computer A sends data destined for B, the switch now receives it, looks at the data coming across the wire, and by definition, what Ethernet does, and this is what protocols and languages are all about, Ethernet doesn't just send the data, doesn't just send the email that I'm trying to transmit to B. It usually includes what's called header information or metadata. Essentially, just as you would send a letter or a postcard through the U.S. postal system, you don't just write the postcard's content, dear mom, dot, 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 love, David, and then drop it in the mailbox. What else do you add to that postcard? Well, an address. You add an address. And in the case of a letter, you would often add a return address. So included with every network transmission are destination addresses and return addresses. Hubs just ignored that information, but the recipient computers would look at it. And if the destination address was for B, B would look at it. But if C received data where the destination address happened to be B, by definition, he would ignore it, unless he were in promiscuous mode. But with a switch, the switch is smart enough only to route that data from A to whoever it is destined for. But now let's consider a slightly more technical problem. How does the switch know where to send the data? You buy this switch from MicroCenter or CompUSA in a shrink wrap box, plug it into your network, plug it into your electrical wall, and connect your three computers in your home, A, B, and C. How in the world does this switch know where computer B even is? The ISP, your internet service provider, actually doesn't come into play here because we could be doing this in complete isolation of the internet. We could just be operating inside of our home. And these devices are so simple, I'll say, that you literally just plug it in as I described.
I was going to say either you have to give it some sort of program to identify what's connected to it, or it has to be arranged such that it will go out and query whatever is attached to it, figure out some sort of be it a header or some sort of address, and then it'll know what's connected to it, and will only allow communications to whatever it's been connected to.
Good. The last part of what you emphasized, which is that the switch figures it out, is absolutely correct. There's fortunately no configuration required on the part of a user when you install a switch in your home or office. What the computer does, and it's worth appreciating this, if only for the security implications, though the fact of the matter is the odds that you would sacrifice any degree of privacy or security during the moment of time I'm about to describe is really negligible. But when a switch is first turned on, it turns out that it does behave just like a hub. The first time A transmits data destined for B, the switch will receive it and sort of, you know, shrug its shoulders, I don't know where B is, and so it just blindly sends it to everyone. But it then pays attention, because by definition, almost every internet service involves not just data going one direction, it involves data coming back, if only to say, I got it. I got that data. So what the switch starts doing is listening. And the first time it hears from B, it makes a note and says, ah, B is connected to this port on me. And typically these ports on the devices themselves are physically numbered. And so the switch essentially associates in the RAM that does happen to exist in the switch like this, because it's sort of like a mini computer, but not in the conventional sense. It just remembers computer B is on port 2. Computer A is on port 1. And the first time it hears from computer C, it will remember that it's on port 3, and thereafter will the transmissions actually be more private. Now, it turns out today, most of you who have computers interconnected in your homes, you do own a switch. Do you agree? Most of you would call it something else. What would you call it? What have you called it tonight?
A router.
So if you look closely, though, at the router that you bought, it would probably was called something like a wireless router with four-port switch. Or even if it weren't called that, if you actually read the list of bullet points of features on the back of the box, a four-port switch or a two-port switch or an eight-port switch would probably be among the features. You can know if you have a switch built into your router by the following simple fact. If you have more than just one connector on the back of that router, more than one Ethernet connector, looks again like a fat phone jack, then you have a switch. And the beauty of these wireless routers and home routers today is that they unite the notion of a switch with the notion of a router with the notion of an access point. Now, we already touched upon what a switch was. It just handles the interconnections of data. What is a router in the context of a home network like this? You can sort of cheat and guess what a router's purpose in life is. That's the one time you can use the word in the definition. It does, in fact, route data from one point to another. Similar in spirit to what a switch does, but we'll see later tonight why a router is particularly more interesting and powerful and a little pricier than just a switch itself. But by price now, I mean, you know, wireless routers today, you can get them for free, frankly, after rebates, but maybe the typical cost is like $40, so it's all quite reasonable these days for what they do. But it's also an access point, and for now, suffice it to say that the fact that your wireless router, if you have such, has those one or two little antennae on the top of it, that makes it an access point, which means it is a point via which wireless laptops can access the router. And in fact, these wireless routers are also what are called proxies or firewalls today as well. But we'll get to that in turn. But first, any questions really on the topologies that we've discussed and perhaps the two pieces of hardware, hubs and switches, with which you can connect to those computers? Yeah. Hubs are indeed being phased out. You don't see them being installed in new networks simply because there's little reason for them.
Mm-hmm. And you were on computer C, how would you know whether you wanted to look at A or B?
You wouldn't look at computer A or B per se. You would be looking at, if this were a hub, the data, the zeros and ones coming across the wire being blindly forwarded to you, and you would look at that so-called header to say, if this data is meant for computer A, well, if you were in this promiscuous mode, C would then realize, oh, this is meant for A, but it looks like it's an email from A to B, and if you were nosy, you could then look at those bits. I'm not sure if I've answered what you were getting at, though. Oh, I see what you mean. It seems you'd have to split the screen somehow. We're not talking about seeing literally what computer A or what computer B is seeing. It's not as though your monitor is now sort of magically, physically connected to their computer. When I say you put your card into promiscuous mode, what I mean is that, among other things, you're probably running some special, if inappropriate, if hacker-like software that shows you in a window the data that is going across the wire. You don't see what A sees on his screen, per se. You see what he has sent across the network. Maybe that is as simple as a URL for, like, www.inappropriate.com or the actual contents of an email that he sent across the wire.
So you wouldn't actually be able to look at the internet site, at the website that the other computer is looking at. You just see the address.
Correct. You would not necessarily see the website, but you could then certainly pull it up yourself. But if he requested it from the internet, and there were also a fourth connection here leading off to the internet on which that inappropriate website is, well, that data is also going to be coming back through, eventually, the hub, being broadcast out to everyone then. And so then C could say, you know what, I'm also going to eavesdrop on any packets destined for A, not originating from A. And then you could actually look at what's called the HTML that's coming back across the wire and literally see the website. And well-written packet-sniffing programs, as these things are called, can do exactly that. It's remarkable, actually. I went to a sort of sales pitch by a local company that was started by, among other people, this fellow at MIT that I work with. And long story short, they essentially have a network device. It's sort of a computer, but sans monitor, that you can plug into your corporate network. And what it does is essentially sit between all of the computers on your network, and it logs everything that goes into the network and out of the network. And the software is so remarkably user-friendly, administrator-friendly, that it's as simple as clicking on, for instance, the letter A on the screen to look at the exact transcript in history of what computer A has done on the internet, looking at where they've sent emails, who they've had instant messaging conversations with, what websites they've visited. So it is absolutely true that the whole notion of Big Brother is incredibly trivial these days to implement on the internet. It's harder to do so, though, for instance, your home or your central office unless you have access to that central point because hubs are no longer so much in use. A couple questions. How do laptops get connected? Let me defer that for just a little bit tonight, and we'll come back to that when we discuss more in detail the idea of a router. Same question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So basically, you know, I was thinking of a router before
Yes, if you have two computers with these so-called Ethernet cards, a picture of which I'll put up in just a moment, you can connect those two computers together in a so-called peer-to-peer network like this using what's called a crossover cable, which we'll get to also in just a moment. It's often, frankly, not as easy as you would like to actually then get the computers to work together because Windows tends not to make it so easy, but it is, in theory, quite possible. Other questions? Well, Ethernet, I keep using this term, and again, it is the language that computers tend to speak when talking on a LAN, specifically. Well, what do these things look like? Well, generally, an Ethernet card is just known as a NIC, a network interface card. Right? In this world, there are many different ways to describe the same kinds of hardware. So NIC is synonymous with Ethernet card. Back in the day, and on older computers today, perhaps even ones in your offices, you would have an Ethernet card like that. And I keep saying card. What kind of card is this exactly? Relating this to lectures 1 and 2. Probably a PCI or an ISA or just more generally an expansion card that's plugged into the back of the computer. These days, and as an aside, networking is so omnipresent and popular in the world that most motherboards actually have an Ethernet jack built into them, so you don't need an additional card. But some computers still do contain these expansion cards, and there were multiple types of connectors on the earliest of Ethernet cards to support different types of wiring schemes, but by far the Ethernet jack with which you're familiar has become the most popular, and the most common card you might see today is that PCI card on the top right, which clearly sticks into the motherboard with those gold pins, but then on the outside you have again that phone jack-like connector, and a common newbie mistake, believe it or not, is to connect accidentally the phone cable to the network jack and then to try to do the network jack to the phone jack, but it doesn't quite work. But realize it's an easy mistake to make. This thing, though, also an Ethernet card. But what for what? It's not wireless, in fact. For a laptop. So this is what's called a PCMCIA card, or just shortened these days colloquially to be PC card, even though they exist for Macs and other computers as well. This is just a thin card about the size of a credit card that slips in usually to the side of one's laptop. And this is called a special connector that came on a lot of 3Com cards and other companies' cards. You just kind of pop it out with a spring and you plug your Ethernet cable in vertically to it. So it's a clever use of space instead of the incredibly annoying and perpetually lost dongle, as they're called. If any of you have ever had a laptop where you have to connect that silly little $50 adapter if you ever need to replace it to the side of the computer, well, this thing has been integrated and is by far a more popular option. But again, these days, most computers, laptops in particular, don't have PCMCIA cards for network cards. It's built into the motherboard and hence just sticks out of the side of the computer because it's built in. But what else might you see? Well, what's this thing? It's also for a laptop. Sorry? It's an internet card, but what does that mean? You're right. Wireless. This is a wireless Ethernet card. So this, too, is one that's designed to slip into the side of a laptop, into the PCMCIA slot. It's a little longer than this one because this is effectively an antenna with a light on it. But this is how, with laptops that didn't come with built-in wireless, some of which you might still have at home, you would add wireless network capabilities. You would buy one of these cards. These days, $20, $40, $60 to buy one, slide it into the side of your computer, install the software that comes with the card on the CD called drivers so that the operating system knows how to talk to the new piece of hardware, and then you would be able to connect wirelessly to what's called a wireless router, which again we'll come back to in a little bit. But these days, how many of you have wireless capabilities in your laptop but don't think you have one of these cards sticking out of the side? All right, so what's happened in this case too? It's built in. So these technologies do exist, and it's certainly relevant for older computers, which is often people's inclination when they want to start a home network. You might just have an old computer sitting in the closet. Wouldn't it be nice to at least put it back into rotation so that you have another terminal that family can check email on, print from, and so forth. Well, such cards as these can expand the capabilities of older computers as well. And this is sort of a ridiculous looking thing, but it was the cheapest manufacturing trick to give desktop computers wireless capabilities. For a while, it was the case that it was cheaper for card manufacturers to build a pretty generic PCI card and then literally slap a PCMCIA card onto it and then put that into people's desktops to give them wireless capability, and it looks as silly as that. These days, it's just a greenish-looking card with the connectors on it that has wireless capabilities into it, but it's an integrated device and not this sort of hack that the industry came up with, presumably for reasons of cost. So those are all NICs. Now, a bit on cabling, which perhaps in and of itself is among the most boring concepts you could ever dwell on. But it's incredibly fun in the context of the course's sections, because next week on the agenda, among other challenges like networking wirelessly and with wires, a number of computers that the staff has spent the past few weeks reassembling after our initial hardware sections, you're also going to create, crimp as it's called, your own Ethernet cables in section and walk home with hopefully your own working Ethernet cable that you can use in your own home. So let's spend just a moment on what these cables are going to look like. At the left here, you have what is called a typical Ethernet cable. Any of you at home with internet access via DSL or cable modems probably have one of these cables. Even if you haven't seen it since the day you plugged your computer in, it's probably connecting at least one computer to your DSL modem or to your cable modem, or to your wireless router, as it may be. The middle cable here is a type of coaxial cable that's somewhat dated, but I offer it just for historical perspective. Most commonly used today are these cables here to network computers. Increasingly common behind the scenes in, say, corporate or university networks are these thinner orange wires. The speed with which you can communicate, if your network has cables like this, tends to be what? How do you describe the speed of a network or the speed of a network cable? Megabytes per second, but actually in the networking world, it tends not to be spoken in bytes, but rather in, spoiled this question, in bits. So megabits tends to be the metric with which the speed or bandwidth of networks is measured. Well, what do I mean by bandwidth? Well, the bandwidth of a network or of a cable is just how much stuff can flow along it at once. So the more bits that can flow along a wire at once, the higher the bandwidth. The more lanes you have on an interstate highway, the higher the bandwidth is of that particular highway because more cars can fit across it per unit of time. So you do measure networking speeds or bandwidth in megabits per second. And what number is usually associated with the speed of, say, home networks? 54 does come into play. What other numbers do you hear in the context of home networks? 28, not megabits, but you're probably recalling 28.8 kilobits per second, and that would be if you're still using an older dial-up modem. So kilo suggesting 1,000, mega suggesting 1,000,000. Those of you, anyone still on dial-up? It's okay, you can admit, here we go. Our one dial-up user is probably suffering the most from the slowest performance because quite literally this is 1,000 times theoretically faster than what a dial-up connection is. Now, the fact of the matter is, your internet connection, those of you with cable modems, DSL, it's probably the rest of you in the audience, well, your internet connections are not this fast, in fact. They're usually closer to what values? Any guesses? So Comcast these days, just recently, started to promise, for whatever that's worth, download speeds of 4 to 6 megabits. RCN, I don't know what they promise these days. Very fast. It's all kind of relative, and I'll show you in a moment a program, a website with which you can test it yourself. Most commonly, for a while, though, was to have cable modems be about 1.5 megabits per minute, per second, rather. But Comcast is increasingly bumping up the download speed for reasons I don't quite understand, because you as a human don't really feel the increasing download speeds, unless, frankly, you're in the business, let's say, of downloading large, if illegal movies or MP3s and so forth.
I was recently talking to a Is that something different from these, or is that...
It is. FiOS is a different technology that uses... it's only being rolled out now, slowly, but I don't know what bandwidth it tends to offer, but it's faster than DSL. DSL continues to be much slower than a cable modem service, and this is perhaps a good juncture to discuss this. Let me start labeling this and come back to that in just a moment, since we're sort of jumping around. 54 megabits per second is usually the speed, maximally, of one's wireless router. Okay, if you buy a wireless router, put it in your home network, and connect computers A, B, and C, the fastest that those computers communicate through this device is 54 megabits per second. Now, appreciate that that value is much faster than, say, a typical cable modem. Which is to say that the bandwidth limitation is rarely going to be the number of computers in your own home, but rather the speed of your network connection, since you have more than enough capacity to share the network connection. So no more complaining that if the kids are using the computer, your connection is slower. That just is not likely to be the case. But it is the case in the world of cable modems that your neighbors are sapping your internet speed. The way the cable industry has laid things out is in such a way that, generally speaking, you and some number of neighbors are all sharing the same physical wiring on the telephone poles or underground on your street, which does quite literally mean 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock rolls around, people get home from work, they hop onto the internet, you will tend to find that your speed degrades. The more people in your neighborhood that are using or are subscribing to cable modem services. Contrast this now with the world of DSL. With DSL, which is just another technology that allows you to connect home computers to the internet, your download speeds tend to be a little slower, though this world is changing now. They tend to be, from Verizon, about 1.5 megabits per second, clearly much slower than 4 to 6 megabits, but it's guaranteed. The number of neighbors using their DSL connections does not affect the speed of your own DSL connection. Now, let's talk price for a moment. Your two most common options these days when choosing between internet providers or technologies is certainly dial-up, though the fact of the matter is dial-up you can probably get for $5, $10, or $15 a month these days. And the speed at which dial-up works at tends to be between 28.8 to 56 kilobits per second. So much, much slower by a factor of 1,000 than the other technologies that exist today. It turns out that DSL these days, whereas this one might be $5, and you kind of have to hunt around to find a deal like that, and your quality may vary. Cable modem, what is Comcast's typical rate these days? Yeah, it's expensive. Ignoring promotions that they've started to run out of marketing necessity, you tend to pay, and I don't remember the exact amount because I myself have been on the promotion for a while, like $40 to $60 a month. I'm going to say closer to $40. But it's ridiculously expensive for the internet connection, world beyond the cost of dial-up. DSL, in the form of Verizon locally, different companies throughout the country do the things differently. DSL from Verizon, I believe now, is sold for a fixed, or at least promotional price of $14.99. Now, this is just an unacceptable difference for most consumers, and you would immediately go to DSL. Comcast, though, for what it's worth, and if any of you are paying, incidentally, $40 to $60 per month with Comcast. You didn't hear this from me, but if you call and threaten to leave for DSL and you quote specifically the price available from Verizon or one of the other DSL providers, they will, if they're like they were with me, give you the DSL price for at least half a year. So I've been paying myself, I think, $20 a month for the past several months. Much more reasonable. So 2 months from now, I will also, I think, threaten to leave again. It seems like too obvious a choice, right? $14.99, guaranteed speed. It is lower, but again, it's guaranteed. What do you think? What should you go with? What should you switch to if you have something different? It's a tough call, and it's sort of a matter of finance, ultimately, right? This is sort of a no-brainer if cost is your prevailing factor. The fact of the matter is that 1.5 megabits download speed is more than enough for what most of us are doing on the internet. Downloading web pages, sending emails, instant messaging, this is overkill for doing something like that. If, however, you're more into the practice of downloading legal movies or legal MP3s or just generally doing more data-intensive work, for instance, even if you work from home and you're constantly downloading large PowerPoint presentations from work, well, four times faster does, in fact, feel better, and it does, in fact, make a difference. But the fact of the matter is DSL is a relatively reasonable option for most people. But this differential, again, is decreasing, and Verizon's starting to roll out better technology than this in the form of Fios, and it remains to be seen where other wireless services are soon available. But for these days, I would say cost should motivate your decision for the typical user. Yeah? Indeed, and that's an important distinction I should note. DSL, by definition, runs over your telephone lines. The speed that you can get to this day is also dependent on how far you are from the so-called CO, or central office of the telephone company, which means, sadly, that those of you who tend to live pretty far out in the suburbs, pretty far away from Verizon's hardware, might not be able to even get DSL, or if you can, it might not even be close to 1.5 megabits per second, because distance very much determines the speed. Cable modem service is less dependent on your distance. Pretty much if you have cable service and Comcast has the right hardware in place, it will work, and you'll get the same speed no matter how far you are from the center of town. But cable modem service, as the description suggests, runs over your cable lines. So unless you're already wired with cable lines, you could not presumably get cable modem service. An excellent question. If DSL runs on your phone lines, does that preclude you from using the phone? Well, those of you from DSL can answer this, who have DSL. You can still use the telephone, because the way DSL works is it essentially sends data at a different frequency than a typical phone call would use, so you can use both simultaneously. But what you typically need from Verizon or the DSL provider is what's called a filter, which allows your current telephones not to interfere with the modem, but they throw those in for free. Okay. Other questions? DSL, cable modem. And you'll see what more of this hardware looks like, the routers and the cables, again, in upcoming sections. Yeah?
How does this way of downloading compare to, in, say, Europe? I mean, are they paying the same kinds of credit?
Local network. I am not current enough on other countries' technologies. I believe Japan's download speed tends to be remarkably faster in a lot of areas, even wirelessly and on cell phones. I know pricing models are somewhat different. I was in Austria recently, and they have a curious approach, at least the ISP that my friends had, which was they charge you per megabit downloaded. So the more stuff that you're downloading, the more web pages you're visiting, the more emails you're sending, the more you're paying, which, you know, may make sense, but in the end, I think they're actually paying much more than we Americans for $15 a month. I would have to defer to Google or some online resource to get a sense of the different numbers. What I can show you locally, though, is a wonderfully useful website, and I would suggest tinkering with this from home, if only to satisfy your curiosity. This is a site called broadbandreports.com. Broadband is just a general term that usually means cable modem, though it's sort of been usurped by just the whole high-speed internet world, so it usually just means you have DSL or a cable modem. Broadbandreports.com is a free website that has a whole bunch of tests that you can run via the network, one of the most useful of which is the one on the left here called Speed Tests. If you visit the site and then find your way down to the Tools menu, and then click Speed Tests, what you'll get is a page like this, which is a little confusing at first, but if you skip all the first steps and look at step 4, you're offered a number of different servers. What you can do is run a program that this website will temporarily install on your computer that tests what your download and your upload speed is. Now, it's certainly dependent on a number of factors, but if you run it a few times, at a few different times during the day or week, you'll get a pretty good sense of what the speed of your network connection is. And fast forwarding to the actual application, I've visited this website before in advance of class. I've pulled up this website, but now I'm going to do the live speed test simply by clicking Start. It tells you don't use your connection, because if I start downloading MP3s in the background, that's going to impact the performance results. This will just take a moment. This happens to be what's called a Java applet, which is a little program written in a language called Java that we'll talk about later in the course that allows you to run software locally via a web page. Well, let's see what our download speed is. It says explicitly, your download speed is what? Yep, oh, so that's, I'm hearing upload speed. Your download speed is 1495 kilobits per second, which is actually relatively slow from here. My upload speed, though, is remarkably fast. It's almost 4 megabits. So notice the translation. It's 3812 kilobits. So that's 3,800 kilobits. So that's 3.8 megabits. But the download speed is pretty low, it would seem. Number of factors could influence that. If you run this at home, you will not see anywhere near that particular upload speed. That's because we're on a very nice university campus with a particularly fast internet connection. Were you to run it at home, it turns out that you would not see an upload speed that even approaches 4 to 6 megabits these days. And it probably doesn't even approach 1.5 megabits. Because the small print that Comcast and Verizon sometimes don't even print is that it's an asymmetric offering. These bandwidths. When you have a 4 to 6 megabit download speed with Comcast for $20 a month or $40 a month, guess what the upload speed actually is, maximally? Just take a guess. It's clearly smaller, because that's where I'm going with this, right? So how much smaller? Half? Worse than half. Sorry? A tenth. Tenth is pretty good. The maximum speed that Comcast tends to give you is 384 kilobits per second. 384 kilobits per second versus 4 to 6 megabits per second down. Now, what are the implications? Well, it turns out for the typical user, not many. Because think about it. How often are you, the home user, uploading big stuff? I mean, you might be downloading big web pages, you might be downloading MP3s or videos, but unless you're serving MP3s and videos, you're not often sending big stuff across the internet. Now, the exception might be what? With what program might you tend to send big thing, pieces of data? Absolutely. If you're sending like email attachments, or you're using a nice digital photo website like ophoto.com or Kodak Gallery or any of those websites designed for digital photos, and you're uploading big files, then you start to feel the effect of 384 kilobits per second on your home connection. But DSL is similarly asymmetric. I don't know what Verizon offers now, because the fact of the matter is they don't really quote download speeds anymore. They talk to you about how much faster it is than cable modem service, or how much faster it is actually than dial-up, without actually committing to numbers. But it's much slower than 1.5. It's a good question. Why the asymmetry, especially when data is traveling along the same wires? Part of it is related to hardware, since especially for DSL, you need certain filters on the lines, and it's simply cheaper to put in half as many filters just for one direction. The other reason is also that they don't want people running servers from their homes. It's fine for the home user to use email, download files, but what they don't want to see happening is people running websites out of their homes, because that means that they can no longer charge small businesses $100 a month for the exact same service, but under the auspices of a small business practice. So I would say it's for both of those reasons, marketing purely and also technological, though more so the former these days. Good question. Other questions on speed? Well, the other thing you can try, too, this is a wonderful website for diagnosing problems you're having, especially when, certainly after this course, you start to feel that level one tech support doesn't quite understand your problem as well as you yourself do when, for instance, you're having intermittent network connectivity issues. Case in point, a few months ago, I was going out of my mind when I had Comcast come out, no joke, 8 times to my apartment because around 9 p.m., 7 p.m. every night for 3 weeks or more, my internet service was just dying until about 9 a.m. the next day. And of course, no tech support guy that I pointed this coincidence out to, that it tends to die when people are coming home, believed that there was any relevance to that, though in the end there actually was. The short of it was I was actually using a number of these tests myself because, of course, Comcast won't come out to your apartment at 9 p.m. They'll come out between 9 and 5 when my internet connection was always working perfectly fine. So what I did was I used such tools as these, one of which I'll demonstrate now, that I took screenshots of, made printouts of various pieces of data that you yourself should now be able to understand after tonight, such as this, line packet loss testing. This particular tool requires that you sign up for a free account on this site, but it is worth it for the following reason. I need to first figure out my IP address. On a Windows PC, and you can play around with this in section as well, the easiest way to find this out is to go to the Start menu, go to Run, and type in CMD for command. Okay, and you'll get a little black window that I already pulled up earlier. You then, at the blinking prompt, want to type IP for Internet Protocol config for configuration, and you'll see something like this. And actually, Comcast and Verizon will often have users doing relatively arcane commands like this these days to help them diagnose problems. Let's take a look at the things that it says. Well, it seems to mention a connection-specific DNS suffix, but three things that we'll come back to later tonight. An IP address, a subnet mask, and a default gateway, and it has two sets of these, because this computer happens to have two connections, one with a wire and one with wireless. The fact that they're both plugged in now is just kind of silly. It's because of the way the laptop is currently set up. So what I am going to note now is what the IP address is. I'm going to type this in. It's 140.247.44.60, and I'm going to click Join the Queue. And when we come back from a 5-minute break, what this program will tell us is exactly what percentage of data is actually reaching our computer from another source, which will tell us if it's not 100%, there's a problem somewhere with our connection. So with that, nail biter, we'll come back in 5 minutes. All right, we are back, and tragically, somehow my ping test got canceled. Let's click on this website and see what exactly happened here. Ah, interesting. I've foiled my attempt at a demonstration here. So, a lot of information on the screen. Try to hone in on the middle of the page where it says test. Below that it says simple ping loss check. Target does not respond to ICM ping. Well, first of all, the word ping in a technical sense means to send a piece of data to another computer and hopefully get an acknowledgement back that that data was received. Incredibly short and simple message. It's essentially a hello. And if you get a response back, that means that host that you said hello to is alive. That is, they're online and functioning. Well, we did not respond to Broadband Report's ICM ping, to their hello to us. And the reason for this is a bit of a nuisance in that Harvard filters out all such ping traffic. Comcast and Verizon tend not to do this, so this test would work on your home network, but what you would see had this worked correctly is that if you had a solid internet connection physically, you would see 100% of these pings got through, because the website will send maybe 10 of them, maybe 50 of them, and then count what percent of them get through. If instead you are seeing what's called packet loss of like 50%, or 75%. That means there's a physical problem either in your home, maybe frayed wiring or some kind of power issue, or one of the so-called routers on the internet is experiencing a problem, be it congestion or be it some hardware failure. And in fact, if we look at this here, and we'll look at another view of this idea in just a moment, notice what seems to be happening. Well, hop zero for now is essentially where the server is for broadbandreports.com. Notice that immediately here, we got 69% loss for some reason, and then here, which is us, 100% loss. So there may actually be a problem here of some sort, but there's clearly a problem here in that no data is reaching me from the outside world. The reason for this, though, is that Harvard, for security reasons, does not let computers on campus answer these hellos, because it's a common trick for hackers to just say hello to a whole bunch of random computers, and the first time it gets a response, it then focuses its attack on a computer it knows exists and is connected to the internet. Good question. If you have a home network with a proxy or a router in the middle, will these pings get through? Most likely yes, because most routers, the router will respond to the ping. It won't actually make it through all the way to your computer. However, many routers offer a configuration feature, which you can see in next week's section when we play with an actual wireless router, of not responding to these pings. The fact of the matter is that the security conscious user probably just wants to turn them off, because it's not common that you need to ping your own server, especially if after this course you don't even remember what it means to ping your server. You certainly don't need to be responding to other people's queries about your own personal computer. But we'll come back to a chart like this in just a bit. For now, again, I told you this teaser on the Ethernet cabling. Well, this is just a historical retrospective here. Coaxial cables were much more in vogue years ago, but they were much more cumbersome because of their thickness, and they were also more expensive. But a coaxial cable is still found in your home. Where? The TV. So that sort of roundish, not very flexible cable that you would connect the TV to your VCR with often, or to your cable box, or to the jack in the wall, is a coaxial cable. And that's what tended to be used, a variant of that, in years past. But these days, by far more popular is Ethernet cabling, as I described it before, but to be more specific now, unshielded twisted pair cabling, UTP. Now, what does that mean? Well, I hesitate to take my scissors to the AV department's own Ethernet cable, as I often do, since we're running out of cables. But this is a UTP cable, unshielded twisted pair. And you'll see these in sections, and you can see these in your own home, in fact, most likely. If you look at this thing closely, you'll see that there are eight wires, eight colorful wires inside of it. A cable generally just means a plastic sheath around actual wires. These are just copper wires. They're identical to what you would find in your phone cables, but phone cables tend to only have, random trivia, how many such wires? Two or four is the typical phone jack connector, and that's actually why it's narrower. Ethernet connectors tend to have eight, but only four of those are actually used. Now, these things are called unshielded twisted pair cables for the following reason. One, they're unshielded. Well, what does that mean? There's clearly some kind of plastic or rubber sheath around it, but it's not insulatory. If you put this too close to a strong magnet or to a strong refrigerator or a power box, you're going to create electromagnetic interference, which is going to degrade the performance. So it's unshielded in that sense. It's twisted. This is where I hurt my fingers every year, because the wires inside of it are all twisted over each other in just a very simple crisscross pattern. Only four of the wires actually convey data. The other four, simply for very neat physical reasons, tend to insulate the other four wires by quite simply being wrapped around them. It creates a better connection. Insulation here is useful only because the less interference means the more of your bits can actually flow through without getting corrupted, without a one accidentally becoming a zero just because there's some electrical source nearby. They're twisted in that sense. There you have a little black and white depiction of them. Only four of them are used, as suggested here. This essentially is an artist's rendition of what the plastic jack, the connector, looks like on the other end. And what it suggests is that pins, wires 1 and 2 are used for TX, transmitting data, and pins 3 and 6 are used for receiving, RX, data, and the other unlabeled wires are just there for insulatory purposes. Now, where is the fun? Well, the fun is actually in taking a wire that has no such connector on the end yet, but instead just has, let's get this right, eight wires popping out of the end of it, and actually lining those up in one of the prescribed patterns, sliding it into a brand new plastic connector, crimping down on it with a special tool that we'll provide you with, and then doing the same, but in opposite order on the other end. It is a wonderfully frustrating experience, but it is also incredibly satisfying when the thing actually does work and starts carrying your network traffic over it at home. What you'll see, though, is that there are two types of Ethernet cables in the world today. What are called straight-through or patch cables. What that means is that the colors on one end of the cable are identical on the other end of the cable. Notice if you look closely at these colors, you've got the little orange candy stripe on the left in the bottom right picture. You've got solid orange, and then the rest. And the pattern is the same on the other side. Hence, a straight-through cable. There's no crossing over in the end. There's a lot of crossing There's a lot of twisting throughout the length of the cable, but when it finally gets to the other end of the cable, everything is back the way it started. A crossover cable, by contrast, does as you might expect. It crosses over the wires. So one end of the cable looks maybe like this. The other end of the cable ultimately looks like this. Effectively, on one end of the cable, what were the transmit wires become on the other end the receive wires, and vice versa. Now, this is an important distinction only because too often do people buy the wrong types of cables from the store. If you want to connect a computer in your home, say, to a switch or to a router, what you want is a patch cable. You want to just patch into that router or switch, so to speak, or that hub. If, however, you want to connect one computer directly to another computer without a hub or switch or router in the middle, well, intuitively, you need to make sure that one computer's transmissions become the other computer's received data. So you want a crossover cable when connecting two computers directly together. And Radio Shack actually, not usually quite good at these things, but they do actually ask the customer if what they really want is a crossover cable or patch cable so that you don't make this particular mistake. But it's an easy thing to fix. If you own your own crimper, you own your own scissors, you can just chop off the end and fix it yourself. But that is perhaps a frustrating... Well, it's unclear whether it's more frustrating to do that or to go back to Radio Shack. So, we'll see. This is what you'll get to do in section, and it is quite fun. And we have 800 feet of cable for you, so we're very tolerant of mistakes in the first attempts of these things. Fiber optic cables, though, we mentioned earlier, though not by name. Those thin orange cables that I pointed out earlier, well, whereas most Ethernet cables today are capable of 100 megabits per second, which is a value we didn't even put up earlier, most Ethernet cables today support 100 megabits per second, and that's what the cables you've seen and you will make in class. Well, fiber optic cables are particularly good, at conveying data at gigabit speeds. 1,000 megabits is simply 1 gigabit per second. So what you're seeing increasingly inside of computer labs, inside of corporate offices, are network speeds in the gigabit range, and then the computers themselves might connect to that network using just 100 megabit connections. The reason being, the backbone of your company, the infrastructure, should probably be faster than the speed supported by one little computer on the network. And the price is justifying the investment in fiber optic cables. Fiber optic, it works sort of fundamentally differently from a typical wire, whereas electricity flows along a cable like this because it's just copper wires inside, like a phone cable. Well, how does data travel along a fiber optic cable? It's light. It's essentially flashes of light that are even closer to the speed of light. Literally are the speed of light, whereas transmissions tend to be slower on cables like this. But you do pay for it. It tends to be a more expensive thing, and you shouldn't stroll into your computer store over the next 2 weeks and ask for some fiber optic cable for your home network, because they probably won't sell it at a typical store, but it's also overkill these days. Because consider, after all, even if your home network's cables are 100 megabits, how fast was your internet connection? If you have a cable modem, let's say. 4 to 6. So even this is overkill. Now, the utility, of course, in having cables that are 100 megabits in your home is that if for whatever reason you're constantly transferring files from your computer to another computer in the home, well, then this is wonderful because it's even faster than your own internet connection. Most people tend not to do that, though, unless you have a file server set up in your own home, which is just not that common. However, what's becoming increasingly likely is that home entertainment systems will soon enough be based on computers, based on like the TiVo type devices of the world, where you'll store movies not on your shelf, but on, say, a hard drive. And the more bandwidth your homes eventually have, the faster you can share that data among your TVs and so forth. And so soon enough, you'll likely see such hardware as this in homes as well. But we shall see. Okay. Well, we spoiled the fun with hubs before in talking about them. This is just another depiction of what we did on the board. This slide, if it helps you remember it, a hub is sort of like this, a four-way intersection, because only one person can talk on the hub at once. Only one person can go through the intersection at once, because hubs not only suffer from that security downfall of blasting the data to all computers, it's also the case that a hub shares its bandwidth among all computers connected to it. And it's for the reason that we note this now, in fact, is because even if you connect 100 megabit cables to a hub and you want to have multiple computers talking at once, well, effectively, they have to share that 100 megabits. A switch, by contrast, guarantees 100 megabit connections between all pairs of computers on the network, A to B, B to C, C to D, C to A, and so forth. So again, a switch is also a more efficient device, not only more secure. I think we will remove this discussion of hubs altogether next year since it's becoming decreasingly relevant. But it's an interesting security and efficiency discussion nonetheless. Switches we've discussed. It's worth noting, though, that a popular topology for switches, as we said earlier, is a star network. But as you would see in a real-world situation, star of star networks are common. Right? You might have one building connected in a star configuration. Well, you might connect multiple buildings on a campus or on an office park to another central point, and so you would scale the thing in the exact same spirit as you would in an individual network. Okay. Questions thus far? All right. Well, let's start talking about how now we've talked essentially about how computers work, how networks work within the confines of local networks, your homes, on a campus. But we really haven't looked at how this all relates to the internet. Well, let's see how it does. When we talk about information flowing on a local area network, a LAN, we said earlier that every computer on a LAN has a sort of addressing scheme, right? A destination and an origin address. Those types of addresses on a LAN are called specifically Ethernet addresses. In other words, any computer on a LAN using Ethernet, which these days is almost every computer on a LAN, has what's called an Ethernet address. This is like a serial number, a unique serial number associated with its Ethernet card, whether that card is an expansion card or it's built into the motherboard. Your Ethernet jack has a unique serial number associated with it called an Ethernet address. And it looks like that. It looks like number, number, dash, number, number, dash, number, number, 12 such numbers, or maybe colons separating the numbers. But 12 digits, and each of those digits or question marks can be any of the numbers 1 through 9, or 0 through 9, or A through F. This is an example of something we'll come back to in our HTML discussion. What base system are we talking about if we're using 0 through 9 and A through F? It's not base 10 or base 2, it's hexadecimal system, and we'll come back to this. But that's the reason for these 0s through 9s and A through Fs. This is to say that every computer in your home, on your home network, has an Ethernet address. It is with these addresses that computer A knows how to send data to computer B. I have an interesting tidbit about Ethernet addresses is the following. Have you ever tried, maybe during some troubleshooting procedure, to disconnect maybe one computer from your cable modem or from your DSL modem, and then try to reconnect another computer, to use another computer on your network, maybe before you have a router? Or conversely, if you think you're having problems with your wireless router, so you disconnect your router from the cable modem and plug a computer in directly. Well, Comcast tends not to tell you this, and Verizon tends not to tell you this, but a cable modem or a DSL modem latches onto the Ethernet address of whatever computer is connected to it. And it will only talk to that computer subsequently until you kill the power. So whenever you are reconfiguring a home network, you should almost always unplug almost everything from the electrical circuits, then plug it back in, because otherwise the lights might still be blinking on the cable modem and the light on the back of your computer might be on, but the cable modem will not let the data go through because all of a sudden it sees a new Ethernet address connected to it. And to be honest, if you take nothing else away from this class, one of the most surefire ways of fixing most problems in this world of computers is to unplug the thing and to reboot it. And that is certainly the case in networks as well. Yes, if you ever want to connect a different computer to your cable modem, and so you unplug one and plug in the other, be sure to turn the power off from your cable modem and then plug it back in. In short, unplug almost everything from the wall before plugging things back in. A question?
Every time I hear a podcast, it keeps telling you to take out an Ethernet cord and flip it around, put it in reverse, and plug it up again. Why don't
you try that? I've not heard that one before. That would do nothing. Because Yeah, that would not achieve anything. I don't know why they tell you that. Maybe it feels like you're doing something then. But as we saw, and as you can tell them, what they're asking you to do is to plug one identical end into the other identical end and to hope that it works then. That is not a good solution. So, it is true though, and these are the kinds of things that will cost you hours of your life late at night. Though you might not think a cable like this can go bad, it is quite possible that sometimes you just have bad hardware. Maybe it's the Ethernet card, which can be expensive, but honestly, you will stumble across, if you play with enough of them, Ethernet cables that go bad. What does that mean? It usually just means that a tiny little 1 cent connector came slightly loose and the cable's no good anymore. Flipping it around doesn't solve the problem, but throwing it out and getting a new one does, or recrimping it. So, don't overlook the obvious, especially after this course, I hope. If you are confident that you know what you're doing and you know what could be wrong and someone thinks otherwise, don't be afraid to question the basics, because frankly, it's not realizing that maybe it's the cable that's bad can save you hours of your life. Yeah?
I have a simple question. So, if you unplug everything, mm-hmm. turn it off, and then you plug everything back in and plug your computer and then turn it on, is that it? Or you can turn it on and then plug it
in? The order doesn't hugely matter, but yes, so long as everything goes into an off state and then comes back on, that tends to be a very easily explained way of fixing things, because for reasons we'll actually talk about in a moment, a lot of processes start at boot up time, and so just making the computer go through those steps again is a very easy way of automating rescue type processes. Okay. So every computer on a local area network has an Ethernet address, but we're still just talking about local networks. Every computer on the internet has what's called an IP address. An internet protocol address. Where have we seen IP addresses before? Or how many minutes ago did we see an IP address? So when I pasted it into broadband reports, right, I had to do IP config, and among the things it told me was my IP address. That is essentially like my postal address for the internet. An IP address is something your computer is assigned, usually automatically, by your ISP. Your internet service provider. That might be Comcast, that might be Verizon, that might be America Online or someone else. But typically when you boot up your computer, one of the first things it does, if it's plugged into a network, is says, hey, ISP, wherever you are, what is to be my address today? Or for the next hour? Or for the next fixed period of time? The language with which your computer makes that request is called DHCP, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. And more useful is to just remember the acronym, DHCP. This essentially is a language that a computer, like yours, speaks to a DHCP server. A DHCP server is owned by every ISP in the world, and they often have multiple ones, but your computer just knows how to find it, because essentially your computer just yells out to every computer it's connected to in the local neighborhood, what is my IP address? And Comcast server, for instance, will respond by telling you, David, your IP address for the day will be 1.2.3.4. Because IP addresses are always in... Come back to this at some point. IP addresses are always in this form. Number.number.number.number. Where each such number sign is a value from 0 through 255. So the one I had a moment ago recall was 140.247.44.60. And that is consistent with the number range we just mentioned, from 0 to 255 for each of them. So again, this is like the unique postal code of my computer on the internet, so that if someone wants to, for instance, instant message me, behind the scenes, I'll never type an IP address of someone I want to instant message directly. This all happens nicely behind the scenes. But my computer, though, will inform that, essentially, that computer who's IMing me will use my address like the mail-to part of an envelope for the postal system, so that whatever instant message they've just sent me will travel over the internet and ultimately make its way to me. The computers on the internet that know what to do with these IP addresses are called, guess what? Too much of a stretch? The computers on the internet that know how to route data based on such IP addresses are called routers. So that is what a router is. If you have, quite simply, and this is where, too, you get to see my nice rendition of the United States, which I'm told each year tends to look a bit like a cow. So if this is, So if that is the United States, here we are in Cambridge, and here might be someone in Stanford University. If someone at Stanford sends me an email, for instance, in a sense, it goes from A to B. But in reality, there are many hops between me and Stanford, each of these dots hereby representing routers, such that my data might actually travel along that path. All of this happens behind the scenes. These routers simply decide at that moment in time what is the best route to send this email from A to B on. These routers are owned typically by large corporations, ISPs, but ISPs of the form of maybe Comcast, but your AT&Ts of the world, Sprint, MCI, big companies that have what are called routers on the backbone of the internet, very large pipes, if you will. Information. This is the information superhighway. These are the very fast connections that connect smaller networks of computers, for instance, the East Coast to the West Coast, together over long distances. So these computers might be owned by a variety of different internet providers, backbone providers, but eventually they all have agreements with each other so that the data should, if the internet is working correctly, get from point A to B. However, it might not each day or even hour by hour take the same path. Because as in the spirit of the ARPANET, things were designed to be resilient and robust to changes, to adapt to changes in performance. So if all of a sudden this route is getting very congested at a certain time of day, well, the routers are, should be designed to start rerouting data on a more available path. But that's what happens between point A and B. Now, how does this all work? Well, when you click send in that mail program at Stanford, how does the email even reach me? Well, there's just a few steps, none of which need to go, we need to go into great technical depth to understand, which are as follows. You hit send. Well, what piece of information have you included in an email to reach me? Not my IP address, though. Me explicitly. If I am sitting here at Stanford and I want to send someone at Ray at Harvard an email, his email address. So we have raydiaz@harvard.edu. Well, one of the first things that happens is that Windows, because it supports what's called TCP/IP, which is the language that all computers on the internet speak, Windows is defined, or Mac OS, Linux, whatever computer you're using that supports networking, essentially does the following. It looks at the email, says, okay, this email is destined for harvard.edu. That computer, my computer, then asks a local server at Stanford, what is the IP address of the mail server for harvard.edu? In other words, where in the world, what is the postal address? What is the IP address of the server that I should actually send mail to for someone, anyone, in harvard.edu? That server is called a DNS server, domain name system, and all it does is the following. It translates names to IP addresses. Harvard.edu will get translated to an IP address like 140.247.x.y, something like that. My computer A now knows, okay, Harvard's mail server is at 140.247.x.y. My computer is then going to assemble an internet packet, just a sequence of zeros and ones in a certain special order. Inside that packet of data, just like an envelope in the world of the postal system, will be a to field. In that to field will go what number now? The 140.247.x.y. In the return address field will go my computer's IP address, whatever that happens to be at that moment in time, that day of the week. That IP address, meanwhile, came from Stanford's DHCP server. I now click send. Behind the scenes, all of those lookups have just happened. Now I have a sort of virtual envelope sitting in my computer that's then sent out my Ethernet card to the nearest router. How does my computer know where the nearest router is? Well, when you say that initial, hello, what's my IP address, you don't just get back your IP address. You also get back this third thing, default gateway. A gateway is a synonym for a router. So you are told automatically when your computer boots up, what your address is and what the address is of the next hop for any traffic that you ultimately want to send on the internet. So my computer also includes in this virtual envelope the address of that router, sends these bits out on my Ethernet card. The router is by the nearest router, the default gateway, is by definition in physical proximity to me, so he hears that along the wire. He then decides, all right, I have an email from A, looks like it's destined for 140.247.x.y. Well, inside of a router is essentially like an Excel spreadsheet that lists IP addresses with directions, and so the router will realize, 140.247, that is that way. And it will literally forward the packet out that connection, which happens to lead to this router, and then that router will make the same decision as well. So all of these routers are to some extent automatically configured to know the best route, but there is also human involvement by system engineers working for these large ISPs who actually program the routers to know where data should go. It is, as an aside, a typical practice for an ISP, a large one like Quest, again, or AT&T, or Sprint, MCI, any of these guys that still own large networks, to try to keep the data on their networks as long as possible, even if that means going like this across the country. The reason being, they have to pay someone money usually as soon as they route that data, not over their routers, but some other guy's router. Well, let's put this into perspective. I'm going to run from a little telnet window here, and I'm doing this from my MIT account, since MIT has far fewer restrictions on what you can do on your network. What I'm going to do is pretend we're actually sitting here at Harvard, even though we're technically down the street now. I'm going to run a program called Traceroute, which, as you might guess, traces the route that data will take between me sitting here and pick your favorite website. Google.com. www.google.com. Enter. A whole bunch of stuff started showing up on the screen. It's starting to get a little slow, but now it's back, and now it's done. 11 lines. Each of those lines represents, guess what? A router. Now, it's all a little slow this time, but let's try to tease apart some of the data. So step one, the first server, the first router, the default gateway for the computer that I have SSH to from my computer, or I'm sitting at essentially now, is called what? w92.rtr-1... Well, that's called the host name of the computer. It's just the English-like name of the computer. But every computer on the internet has an IP address. What is the IP address of MIT's default gateway?
18761.
Exactly. So look, put your eyes on line 1, scroll to the parentheses, and you see now the corresponding IP address for the router that happens to be called the more esoteric W92-RTR router, is probably what that denotes. Well, notice now, if you move to the side, it says 0.652 milliseconds. That is the amount of time that it took data to get from the computer I've connected to at MIT to the default gateway, to the nearest router. So less than a second to get there. Well, let's keep looking. Line 2, we already seem to be on a router that has something to do with a backbone. So it's probably a more expensive, a faster, a bigger, more central router. Line 3 apparently belongs to a company called Cogent, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, which is an ISP of sorts. It seems to be the ISP, or one of the ISPs, to which MIT connects, one of the companies that MIT buys its internet service from. Well, in what town is that connection? It's in Boston. Now, this isn't guaranteed to have reasonably sounding names, but the convention tends to be. So we seem to have, between routers 2 and 3, some physical wire leading from Cambridge, Massachusetts, down on Mass Ave, to across the river in Boston somewhere. Well, lines 4 and 5 get a little more interesting. We seem to go from two routers within Cogent, from line 3 to 4. Where do we end up? Take a guess in line 5. New York. So routers tend to be named after airport codes. So it turns out that between routers 4 and 5 are several states. There is a wire leading from wherever that router is in Boston to wherever the next router is in New York. And the reason we know that is we're inferring from the name in 5 that JFK denotes a router in New York. How much time did it take? Well, if we scroll to the right this time, you see 5.949 milliseconds. So it took just under 6 milliseconds for data to go from my computer to New York. That's pretty fast. What about step 7? Well, already in step 7, we seem to be within the domain of Google. Steps 8, 9, 10, 11, they don't seem to have names, but that's okay. Computers must have IP addresses. They don't need to have host names associated with them. Well, how long did it take in the end to get from us to Google? Well, it looks like just under 27 milliseconds, looking at the first number in the last line. Not bad, but it looks like these servers for Google that we connected to are on the East Coast, even though Google's based in Mountain View, California. Well, let's try another case, farther away perhaps. Give me your next favorite website. Okay, I heard Craigslist. So Craigslist.org has a trace route of the following. Ah, this is a little more interesting too now. So step 1, we're through the same router. That makes sense because my computer hasn't moved, so the default gateway is going to be the same. Step 5, we also seem to be in New York. Where do we end up in step 6? Washington, D.C. So named after one of their airport codes there, IAD, Dulles's code. We stay in D.C. for step 7. Step 8 is probably still in D.C. as well. Step 9 looks like there's what's called a peering point between steps 8 and 9. There's some kind of financial relationship between Cogent and a company called Vario.net, whereby the former passes data along to the latter when necessary. And where do we seem to end up? Well, we're going to have to make an inference here. Notice, between steps 8 and 9, there's a remarkable change somewhere. What changes notably between steps 8 and 9? The time. We're going from like 5 milliseconds, or rather from 13 milliseconds to like 71 milliseconds. What does that suggest to you? It's a long way. It could just be a slow router, but more likely is there's some distance between us. So where might it be? Well, this Vario server, or PLACA, SNF, it's probably California, San Francisco specifically. Tough to guess with these host names, but that's likely the case. Now, these cases here, there's still routers. Some routers, just like at Harvard's network, are designed not to respond to the kinds of requests that trait route triggers. So they exist, but they're not answering our requests for some interesting information about them. Well, let's try one other experiment. We visited last week www.cnn.co.jp. Let's see if we can take a look at this route. So this is literally the path that data travels from me to CNN's Japanese web server. All right, we start off in line 1 at the same default gateway. We seem to be going in lines 6 and 7 to Washington, so it could be DC there as well, making an inference. We have no names for a lot of these steps in 9 through 19, but could you tell me where the Pacific Ocean is? Probably not 16. So 11 to 12, or rather 10 to 11, it looks like, we're going from about 80 milliseconds to what? 189. Now that suggests to me there's an ocean in between us. And the tendency tends to be to go to the left, to the west, and go across the Pacific Ocean rather than going through Europe to get to Japan for a lot of these connections. I'm guessing here based just on experience, but it's tough to say where these things are when people don't conveniently name them after, say, airport codes. But there is clearly a huge jump in time between steps 8 and 9 and then 9 and, or rather, 11 and 12. So I'm guessing what's happening is between steps 8 and 9 is the United States and all of the time zones in between us and the California. And then with those last two steps, is there a hop literally across the Pacific Ocean? A really thick cable that a really big boat laid several years ago connecting California to either Hawaii to Japan or directly to Japan or just generally somewhere in Asia. Such things do exist. And it's funny, if you pay close attention, sometimes in the more scientific media, you will see articles such as those years ago about how sharks were a problem for one such transatlantic cable because there were what are called repeaters along this thick cable on the ocean floor. Repeaters being devices that take a weak signal in and amplify it, so to send it a farther distance. Well, these repeaters essentially sent out a noise or an electrical pulse that attracted the curiosity of a local shark population, which was not good for keeping the cables intact. So there are a huge number of issues involved in laying cables thousands of feet, miles underwater. So it's an interesting problem, but it has been solved. And it is, in fact, physical connections that exist among the continents today. So those are our routes. I suggest that you play with this. You can do this on your own computer at home, usually if you have a PC, not by typing ipconfig at this same prompt, but type traceroute, but leave off the O-U-E for saving. So you have traceroute, T-R-A-C-E-R-T, is the same command. You can then type the name of your favorite website and trace the route from your physical computer to that computer. And just appreciate that if you send an email to someone in California and then run traceroute to that person's domain name, like stanford.edu, you will literally be watching the path that that email just in under a second took to get from, in that case, B to A. It's pretty wild. I think this kind of blew my mind when I sort of watched the path that email was taking when I first used to email my mom in college. It would go from Cambridge, Massachusetts to all the way down to New York, to D.C., and then for some reason back up to Connecticut. So on the internet, the shortest path between two points is not necessarily a straight line, as my art suggests as well. Questions on internet protocol or the routers that make use of the IP addresses? Yeah.
You've indicated that it's your IP address for that session. So if you power off your machine at the end of your session, you come back on, it's going to be a different IP address.
Quite possible. Every time you turn on your computer, and even sometimes while it's on, your IP address could change. The fact of the matter is most ISPs, Verizon and Comcast, do not bother changing your IP address often. And I think I've had the same one for several years, for instance. But the protocol allows them to make such changes as those. Now, we overlooked an important detail in our discussion of email that's relevant to, say, our web transactions. When have you ever gone to http://1.2.3.4? I mean, probably never, but you've probably gone to CNN.com or MSNBC.com or Google.com because clearly humans can remember words and company names better than they can esoteric numeric addresses. So just as DNS servers translate the domain names and email addresses to the appropriate IP address, so do such things as DNS servers also help out your browser. So when you type in CNN.com, your browser by way of Windows or Mac OS says, hey, local DNS server, what is the IP address for CNN.com? And it's then that number that is technically contacted by your particular computer. How do you determine where you're actually going? Well, another command you can type on FAS or on your own Windows box is the NS lookup command. And I'll try it on Windows this time. NS for name server, lookup, and then like CNN.com. Enter, and wow! Not only does CNN have one IP address, they have several. Why in the world would CNN.com be associated by the DNS system with multiple numeric IP addresses, do you think? Traffic. So the beauty, too, of the DNS system is that you can have multiple servers providing the illusion of just one central website. FAS, as you'll soon see, works the same way. You will SSH, as we say, to fas.harvard.edu using something like secure CRT. And all of this jargon will make sense when we start dealing with web pages. But fas.harvard.edu does not exist. It is simply a moniker for many different machines, each of which has its own IP address. And when you SSH, connect to fas.harvard.edu, the DNS system and other pieces of hardware at Harvard automatically sends you to hopefully the least busy of those servers so that you have the fastest possible server. However, each of those computers, just like with CNN, they obviously display the same content because they ultimately share some resources, copies of the day's news or, for instance, a central file server. But it's a wonderful tiered system that allows you to create the illusion of one machine when there actually are several. A final note, I think, if we may, on wireless, since we won't need to make use of some of our pictures, but I think it's worth talking about Mr. Bluetooth here. We talked briefly about wireless today in the context certainly of wireless routers. Well, clearly wireless is one means by which you can connect computers to a central point. An access point is just a wireless device that connects other wireless devices. So I said earlier that routers today are both routers. They route data from the internet to multiple computers behind your home network. They also provide access point services because you can connect to them wirelessly if they have the antennas. And you can also connect multiple computers to them with cables because they are also switches. Well, the technology via which you can connect wirelessly to such devices is called not Bluetooth, but Wi-Fi, colloquially. So if you've ever heard of Wi-Fi, Wi-Fi is just the standard with which you can connect wirelessly to local computers. The bandwidth to that, recall earlier, was this number 54 megabits per second. That's pretty much the speed of today's Wi-Fi connections. Slightly older routers only supported 11 megabit connections, but if you go out today and buy one, you're getting 54 megabits. And if you want to be really technical, you can go into the store and ask someone for an 802.11g router. That is the technical description of what is more commonly called Wi-Fi. Contrast this with, meanwhile, this, which you might have read about, WiMAX. What is WiMAX wireless technology? So the bandwidth of this is not particularly greater than 802.11g. Its distance is simply much bigger. With something like Wi-Fi, 802.11g in your home, you can usually cover a reasonably sized house with just one wireless router or access point, probably roughly in the middle of the house somewhere. If you want to connect a city wirelessly, as Philadelphia wants to do, and as other cities in the U.S. increasingly want to do, well, you don't want to have a wireless access point every 100 feet along a city street. It just doesn't make sense financially. So WiMAX is a similar technology, but it's capable of much larger distances. And it is this technology that increasingly in the media you hear about cities wanting to roll out for free internet service to local citizens. It remains to be seen how and when this happens, or if it does, but that's where the jargon is related. Bluetooth, meanwhile, is more of a very local wireless technology. It allows you to, for instance, synchronize your cell phone with maybe your computer, with the contact list on your computer. It allows you, in theory, to stroll past a Starbucks and have an advertisement for a free cappuccino blasted to your cell phone as you walk past that Starbucks if your phone supports Bluetooth. Perhaps the most common use today, if you're one of these people, is to have one of those big things on your ear so that you can talk into your cell phone without having a wire go down to your pocket where your cell phone is. These are Bluetooth headsets. Bluetooth, in short, is just another wireless technology, but has even a shorter range than something like Wi-Fi, on the order of feet or meters. Nothing particularly remarkable. And what you'll see in the upcoming section, not this week when you focus on treasure hunting, but in next week when you focus on the internet again, is you will actually connect multiple staff computers, PCs, probably a laptop, maybe a Mac, all to a wireless router. You actually get your hands dirty with the configuration of these things, crimping your own cable so that by section's end, you've actually built your own wireless network in the span of just a couple of hours, skills you can hopefully then parlay to your own home network. And as a useful exercise, I would strongly encourage you, if you haven't already, to at least reinforce the material we did earlier in the course in lectures 1 and 2 by going home one night or going to the office one day and literally unplugging every cable from the back of your computer, and a useful exercise indeed would be to plug things back in without leveraging the color coding that tends to exist on them today. It is a wonderfully useful trick to reinforce, even more so when we get to the networking stuff. So with that said, we will see you next week.